What the opening of relations with Cuba means for the U.S. and for Maine. This Friday, John Kerry travels to Cuba to formally raise the Stars and Stripes over the U.S. Embassy. It will be the first visit by a U.S. Secretary of State to Cuba since 1945. This comes a little more than a month after President Obama announced plans to restore diplomatic ties with Cuba, which were cut off by President Kennedy in 1961. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll discuss the significance of the changing relationship with Cuba, what still needs to happen to normalize relations, what Congress is likely to do about economic sanctions, and how the lifting of travel restrictions affects both countries, and more. We'll be joined by both of Maine's U.S. senators, as well as a professor of history from Bowdoin College and a longtime activist with the organization Let Cuba Live. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. And from the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling.
Today, I can announce that the United States has agreed to formally reestablish diplomatic relations with the Republic of Cuba and reopen embassies in our respective countries.
That was President Obama a little more than a month ago announcing a fundamental revamping of the relationship between the U.S. and Cuba. Friday, Secretary of State John Kerry heads to the island nation to reopen the U.S. embassy in Cuba. Today, we're going to talk about the end of the Cold War between these two countries and the work that still needs to be done. With me in the studio, Alan Wells. He is the Roger Howell Jr. Professor of History at Bowdoin College. Tom Whitney is also in the studio with me. He practiced pediatrics for 35 years and is now a political journalist writing mostly about Latin America, especially Cuba and Colombia. He's a longtime member of Let Cuba Live, a Maine-based committee organized in 1992 to promote respect for Cuba's sovereignty and independence. And joining us from our Bangor studio is Maine's senior senator, Susan Collins. Senator Collins, who recently returned from an official trip to Cuba, wrote about it, and she is able to be with us for just a portion of our program today. As always, we want to hear from you. What do you think of our relationship with Cuba? Have you been to Cuba? Do you have ties to the island nation? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address is talk@mpbn.net. You can send a tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. And before we start our discussion today, I want to share a bit of news that we have. We invited the poet Richard Blanco to be on the program today or join us by phone. And he sent us an email that said he couldn't because he's in Miami. And what he's doing right now is writing. He's doing some media down there. He wrote, "The State Department has asked me to write a special poem that I will read at the reopening ceremony of the U.S. Embassy in Cuba on Friday." So a little news right there that Maine poet Richard Blanco will be reading at the official ceremony this Friday in Cuba. Senator Collins, I want to start with you today since you can only be with us for just a little while. You recently traveled to Cuba and wrote a special report about the trip. It seems like quite an experience. Did that trip change any of your views about the United States' relationship with Cuba?
It was a fascinating trip that gave me a much better understanding of the challenges and the changing relationship between the two countries. I left Cuba optimistic about the rebuilding of normal relationships between our two nations, but convinced that we need a step-by-step approach. So my views were changed in that I felt that the trip made me more educated about the challenges of reestablishing the relationship. I very much support lifting the travel ban so that Americans can travel freely to Cuba. I don't think that we should be restricting the basic American right to travel except to war zones or in other exceptional circumstances. And I think that that's a good beginning. I also supported the reopening of our embassy in Cuba, which has been closed since 1961, and the reopening of the Cuban embassy in Washington.
Senator Collins, the president can open an embassy and ease some travel restrictions, but economic sanctions are in the hands of Congress. Do you support lifting the economic sanctions against Cuba, and do you believe there are the votes in Congress to do so?
Well, there are people in Congress who are opposed to lifting even the travel restrictions. In fact, the House voted for an amendment to keep in place the current travel restrictions. I'm hopeful that in the Senate, where there's far more support for lifting the travel restrictions, that our position in favor of lifting those restrictions will prevail. On the embargo, I believe that we should start in a co-sponsored a bill to allow more trade between our two countries. But there are degrees. The one major question is whether Cuba should have access to the economic loans that we give frequently to foreign countries so that they can buy American products. And what I do want to make sure is that we do keep in mind that while we should move to a completely normal relationship, that we should not forget about Cubans' human rights violations and the fact that this still is a one-party state where Raul and Fidel Castro have already selected the individual to replace them in 2018, and where dissidents are still punished for taking on the regime. So I think we need to continue to stress human rights, and as we liberalize our relationship with Cuba, make some of that contingent on progress towards more freedom for the Cuban people.
Senator Collins, one of your colleagues, Senator and presidential candidate Marco Rubio, is calling on Secretary of State John Kerry to visit with Cuban dissidents on Friday. Do you agree with Senator Rubio?
I do believe that it would be good for Secretary Kerry not only to visit with the official Cuban government officials, but also with members of the dissident community. I met with a major dissident prior to going to Cuba, and he really opened my eyes to how desperately poor the Cuban people are. He encouraged me to bring all sorts of toiletries with me that I gave to the Catholic Church to distribute to the people there. And had I not had that meeting, given how controlled by the government much of our itinerary was, I think I would have not understood the need to go down the side streets away from the heart of Old Havana, which is very beautiful. And down those side streets, you see desperately poor people, crumbling buildings, and an infrastructure in need of repair. I think the best way to improve life for the Cuban people, however, is to have more trade between our two countries so that we can help the Cuban people who are desperately short of certain food products. They do not, for example, have a dairy industry. They're short of seed potatoes. I made a pitch for seed potatoes and blueberries while I was there meeting with trade officials. So I do believe that a better relationship will improve the lives of the Cuban people, but we do have to keep in mind that dissidents are severely punished. I don't agree with Senator Rubio on the general approach to Cuba, where he has a very hardline approach and would not lift the travel restrictions.
I'd like to bring our other guests into the conversation now. Alan Wells, let's take a step back. Can you put in perspective the significance of this change in U.S.-Cuba relations? When your students return in just a couple weeks, all of whom were born during this time period in which and most of the parents of your students probably born after 1961, how do you characterize for them, for this generation, the significance of what's going on right now?
Thanks for having me, Jennifer. I you know, the United States and Cuba has had a long history and in many ways a special relationship dating back to even before the Spanish-American War. I won't give a long history lesson here, but to say that the United States has been intimately involved in Cuba's political, economic, and even cultural life. And when the revolution came in 1959, that that changed that relationship. Since 1959, the United States strategy by both Republican and Democratic administrations has been, can be summed up in two words, regime change. The idea was to bring about a change in regime, and that was tried by successive presidential administrations, and it didn't work. And I think President Obama alluded to that in the speech that he made in December of 2014. The policy wasn't working, and so a new approach was needed. And I think that's the result of what you've just seen.
Tom Whitney, you've long been involved in an organization, Let Cuba Live, which is a Maine-based organization. This is not a state with a large Cuban population. We're not geographically close to Cuba. Why do you care so much about Cuba?
Well, Maine is part of the United States, and we have a notion of how the United States ought to act vis-a-vis the rest of the world. And Cuba, in my opinion, I don't speak for myself, is an object lesson of how not to act with other peoples in the world. And as Alan said, there is a long history. And also, Senator Collins mentioned a rebuilding of normal relations. I would suggest, perhaps exaggerating, but I don't think by much, I don't think relations have ever been normal between our countries. In the 19th century, there was a tight relationship between slave owners in both the island and the states of how you could where slaves would thrive the best. And there was an annexationism, it was called, of that Cuba would become part of the United States. Then commercial interests in the late 19th century and certainly after 1902, after what we call the Spanish-American War, where the United States really owned the commerce and much of the land, the productive land. And since 1959, Cuba has had to cope with the embargo, or what we call it a blockade, and a whole bunch of other stuff. So relations have not been normal between the two.
I want to play a little bit of President Obama's speech on July 1st about his decision to work toward normalizing relations with Cuba.
But there have been very real, profound differences between our governments. And sometimes we allow ourselves to be trapped by a certain way of doing things. For the United States, that meant clinging to a policy that was not working. Instead of supporting democracy and opportunity for the Cuban people, our efforts to isolate Cuba, despite good intentions, increasingly had the opposite effect.
Senator Collins, I want to get your reaction to the president's way of framing this, not only as a way of changing policy, not clinging to a policy that's not working, but also, and there's hints this throughout what the administration, not only the president, but also the Secretary of State and others in the administration have said, a way of changing the relationship in order to empower the people of Cuba. Is this thought process the same one that you follow?
I agree with the president that our policy, which was first instituted by President Kennedy, who instituted the embargo and the restrictions on trade and financial transactions and travel, has not worked. It has not led to a regime change, which had been the hope. And we've tried it for more than 50 years, and it's evident that we need to change. I also believe that it doesn't make sense not to have a better relationship with a country that's only 90 miles off our shores, and a country that has many ties to the United States, as your other two guests have pointed out. And one is only to go to Miami to meet a great number of Cuban Americans who are split on this issue, I might add. So I agree with the president's conclusion that the policy has not worked, that we need to try a different approach. My only hope is that he does not forget that he still needs to pressure the Cuban government to allow more freedoms for its people and a better way of life for the people. I did see changes when I was in Cuba. For example, there is some private enterprise there now. I ate, for example, in a privately owned restaurant called Paladar. They are generally doing much better than the state-owned restaurant, despite very heavy taxes and licensing requirements. And Cuba does now realize that it desperately needs foreign investment, because ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union, which was really propping up the Cuban economy, times have been very difficult for the average Cuban citizen. And the easing of the embargo in steps will improve the lives, in my judgment, of the average Cuban citizen, but I want that to be accompanied also by more political freedom and by an end of the imprisoning of people who disagree with the regime and crackdowns on dissidents, which we're still seeing.
Senator Susan Collins, thanks so much for carving some time out to join us for Maine Calling today. I know you have to leave now. Also, we're hoping to hear from Senator Angus King after the break. Senator Collins, thank you again for joining us. And we are going to take that break. We'll be right back. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Cedars, a nonprofit senior living community in Portland since 1929, offering independent living at the Atrium, thecedarsportland.org. The Central Maine Heart and Vascular Institute, offering minimally invasive valve surgery. Learn more at cmhvi.org. And Friends School of Portland, where Quaker values create a culture of joyful learning. Information at friendsschoolofportland.org.
Thousands of African elephants are slaughtered each year by militias and terrorist groups, which then smuggle the ivory in return for cash and weapons. On the next Fresh Air, journalist Brian Christie talks about his cover story for National Geographic. He and his team planted fake tusks with GPS tracking devices to follow the trails of smugglers. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. And join us each evening at 7 for the PBS NewsHour on MPBN Television. It's news the way you want and expect your television news to be. The top stories and issues of the day, objectively explored and discussed in depth with differing viewpoints. It's news you can trust. The program brings prominent guests and intelligent voices to the mix and brings us reports on the most important issues of the day from around the globe, all helping to make sense of our complicated and ever-changing world. The PBS NewsHour, weeknights at 7 on MPBN Television, and also with another chance to watch at midnight. And if neither of those times are convenient, you can watch it each evening over the air and on cable on MPBN's World Channel at 10.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the evolving relationship between the United States and Cuba. With me in our studio, Tom Whitney, a former pediatrician turned journalist and a longtime member of Let Cuba Live, a Maine-based committee that has promoted respect for Cuba's sovereignty and independence. Alan Wells is a professor of history at Bowdoin College. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net. tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us now by phone, U.S. Senator Angus King. Senator King, in June, you and Senator Jerry Moran introduced the Cuba Trade Act of 2015. What would this bill do?
Well, basically, it would open up trade between the United States and Cuba, with the exception, as Senator Collins mentioned, of not providing U.S. taxpayer support for those kinds for that kind of trade. But it's sort of a complement to opening up the travel embargo. Of particular interest in Maine and across the country are agricultural products, whether it's rice from Arkansas or potatoes from Maine or dairy products. Anything related to agriculture is a big opportunity for Maine business, for Maine and national businesses, but also just generally. And I thought this made sense for a long time. In fact, I'll tell you a funny story. I was at the national governor's meeting back around, 2000, 2001, and happened to sit at the same table with President Bush. And I said to him, why don't we just forget about this embargo stuff with Cuba? Because, you know, once we normalize relationships, a lot of the problems are going to be diminished. And he looked at me like I was absolutely out of my mind because of Florida politics and national politics. But I think finally we're getting to a place where we can start to make some of these common sense decisions that I think should have been made a long time ago. I mean, as you point out, 56 years is about long enough to try a policy that doesn't work, and maybe it's time to do something different. I don't think we should have any illusions that opening up trade is going to quickly or overnight modify the autocratic nature of the regime. But certainly, as your guests have pointed out, I think it's going to make life better for ordinary people in Cuba.
Senator King, what do you believe the chances of your bill passing are?
Well, I'm teamed up with Jerry Moran, who's a Republican, leading Republican senator from Kansas. He actually was one of the people that sponsored the bill opening up some agricultural trade with Cuba back in the year 2000 when he was in the House, and everybody told him he was crazy, it would never happen. And he's a pretty persistent and capable guy. So I think between the two of us, we may actually be onto something. There still are hardcore people that just say, you can't do it. And, you know, I often wonder, well, what about all the trade we do with China? They're certainly an autocratic regime with human rights problems, but, we don't have any trouble normalizing trade relations with them. So I think this is really a remnant of the, it's almost pre-Cold War. And I do think we have a shot at it. I'll be honest with you, being on the same side as Jerry Moran on this one, I think helps the bill considerably, because I've recently noticed that the Republicans control both houses of the Congress.
Senator King, I was going to have Alan Wells pose you a question to you.
Yeah, Senator sure. King, first of all, I'm heartened by your by the move that you're making here to introduce this to restore trade relations with Cuba. There are a number of outstanding claims that date back to the early years of the Cold War, property claims of U.S. companies who did business there, and even claims of individual Cuban Americans who had property there. That's always been a sticking point. Do you foresee that being a problem moving forward?
I think it'll be a problem, but not an insurmountable one. I think they're going to have to work through those sort of case by case and work with the Cuban government. I'm not sure what the attitude is going to be. Obviously, I don't think the Cuban government is going to turn around and say, oh, we're going to give back these big sugar plantations or big land holdings to people that fled the island in 1959 or 60. It's interesting. I've talked to members of the Cuban American community from Florida, and it's a real generational split. As you probably know, the yeah. older generation are still adamant. They hate Castro. They don't want anything to do with it. They want, in fact, some of the politicians I've heard say, well, if we just gave the embargo a couple of more years, it would work, which I just don't think passes a straight face test. But I think that is going to be an issue. I don't think it'll be insurmountable. And again, I can't help but think that normalizing economic relations with people that are so close to us geographically and in other ways can't help but ease the political situation somewhat, although I do think it's going to take time.
I couldn't agree more. One sticking point as far as the Cubans are concerned, you know, for Cubans, it seems like nationalism is in their DNA. It has been these American-funded what are called democracy promotion programs, campaigns that the United States have given funds to dissidents in Cuba. And this has raised all kinds of issues about human rights. And in fact, the American diplomat, Alan Gross, who worked for AID, who was let out of the country as part of the normalizing of relations, you know, he was channeling tens of millions of dollars of U.S. funds in the form of highly sophisticated communications equipment that would allow Cubans to secretly work in undetectable Wi-Fi hotspots without the Cuban government's knowledge. And I think that those are kinds of the issues that are going to present problems moving forward for normalization. I wondered if you could comment on that.
Well, as I say, I think, you know, you've got to keep your eye on the big picture and at the same time deal with issues like this one at a time, but not let them dominate or take over. I think it would be awkward to for us to be seen as trying to actively destabilize the regime at the same time we're promoting trade. I think, you know, that's why they invented diplomats. We're going to have to work through those things. But I think what we've learned from this, and it's an important lesson in historically generally, and we're somewhat talking about this now with Iran, sanctions are rarely effective against autocratic regimes. The top people are always going to get their Mercedes or whatever it is that they want. And it's the people that suffer, and they don't necessarily get the results that we want. And Cuba's a prime example of that. The people have suffered, and we haven't gotten the results, the political results that we want. So, yeah, I think there are going to be continuing issues. There's no question, given the long history or non-history of the last 50 or 60 years and the history of the United States with Cuba, as your other guest pointed out, going back into the 19th century. But that's why we, you know, that's why we have our diplomatic corps, and we're going to try to just have to work through them. But again, not rise to the level of destroying the relationship utterly, which serves no one's purpose.
Senator Angus King, thank you so much for joining us today on Maine Calling.
Great to be with you, Jennifer. And you had two U.S. senators on one day. Think of that.
I know.
More or less. We pretty much agree with each other. That's a good thing. Thanks, Jennifer.
See you later.
See you guys.
And we're going to go to some other calls right now. Let's see here. We'll start with Larry in Bangor. Hi, Larry. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I think it's always best to talk, so it's been silly that we haven't been talking for all these years. I'd even be willing to talk to Governor Page, although I don't think he can hear. But more importantly to my mind right now is our constant harping on human rights. I certainly am in favor of human rights, but we Americans incarcerate more people than anyone else in the world. When I was a boy, you could be thrown in jail for 99 years for smoking one joint. You know, we need to talk about our human rights before we talk about other people's human rights.
Larry, thanks for your call. And, you know, this is a topic that keeps coming up. Tom Whitney, do you have thoughts on, you know, you've really strongly believed in Cuba's independence, but there is a legitimate concern about the human rights record there.
Yes, I am in favor of human rights, no question. But there are some footnotes. One is the mercenaries. Political opponents, the dissidents, and there were some arrests for a few hours this weekend. That story that I saw was a little confusing as to the numbers, but I would point out that many of those so-called dissidents are in the pay of the U.S. government. And as there is the other dimension of human rights, which we in the United States don't talk about too much, which are economic and social rights, the right to have health care, the right to have good schools, education for everybody. The United States does not often honor that. And as was pointed out by Senator King, we deal with countries, China, you could add a whole list, the right-wing government of Honduras, Saudi Arabia, and so forth, that do not honor human rights. So there is some hypocrisy there, in my view.
All right, we're going to move to Tom in Rockland. Hi, Tom. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello. I know this question is probably for the distant future, but I think critics of America have been a little bit too loose using the word imperialism about America. But for me, the Spanish-American War and the McKinley-Roosevelt administrations were actively imperialistic. And I think one vestige of that is Guantanamo Bay. And I just wonder what the feelings of be about someday giving it back to Cuba. I think that's part of the sovereignty. Thank you.
Yeah, that has been a point of some concern by the Cubans. They felt that it should be returned. In fact, Fidel Castro famously put all of the checks that the United States government, the United States makes a rental payment every year for Guantanamo, and he never cashed one of those payments. So he put them in a drawer somewhere, as the story went. I think this is something that sticks in the craw of many Cuban nationalists, and they'd probably like to see it addressed as part of the process of normalization. I think one of the things we're going to have to keep in mind is that when we talk about normalization, we have to see it as a process that's going to take some time. There are going to be sticking points on each side that are going to have to be addressed. It's really not so much about the absence of conflict as the management of conflict moving forward. And Guantanamo is just one of many issues that are going to have to be dealt with.
Interesting question. Thank you, Tom. We're going to move to Douglas in Booth Bay Harbor. Hi, Douglas. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. This is Douglas. I'm a summer resident of Booth Bay Harbor, so I am from away. But I really like listening to this show and this issue. Susan Collins is one of the few reasonable Republicans in Congress. But I would just comment, she talks about the poor and the poverty there. Let's realize that it was the U.S. embargo that basically confined that, or it helped it. I would point out that the Vietnamese War begins and is around this same time, and we have essentially normalized relations diplomatically, economically with Vietnam. It's more than time to do it for Cuba. Thank you.
Thank you, Douglas, for your call. And on that note, we have to take another short break. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Ollie's Trolley, offering narrated daily tours of Cadillac Mountain, tickets and more information at ollie'strolley.com and Casella, dedicated to improving air quality for all Mainers through a commitment to reduce its carbon footprint. Casella, giving resources new life.
Wake up to the world.
Hello, I'm Dan Damon, host of the BBC's World Update program, and I'm here every weekday morning with all the latest global news, views, and analysis. From Tehran to Tokyo, wherever the news is, World Update will make sure you know about it. So don't let the world pass you by while you sleep. Wake up to me, Dan Damon, and wake up to the world.
BBC World Update each weekday morning at 5 a.m. And join us at 1 o'clock following Maine Calling for World Affairs. Today's speaker, Timothy Reif, General Counsel of the Office of the United States Trade Representative. He'll explain why the TPP has become the centerpiece of President Obama's global trade agenda. That's World Affairs coming up after Maine Calling at 1 o'clock here on MPBN Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, What's Next for the United States and Cuba? With me in our studio, Alan Wells, who's a history professor at Bowdoin College, and Tom Whitney, who's a former pediatrician, now a political journalist, and a longtime member of Let Cuba Live. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. I want to play one more piece of sound. This is from Secretary of State John Kerry this summer. And this is what he was saying at the same time the president was announcing the normalizing or the effort to normalize relations.
The United States and Cuba continue to have sharp differences over democracy, human rights, and related issues. But we also have identified areas for cooperation that include law enforcement, safe transportation, emergency response, environmental protection, telecommunications, and migration.
It's interesting to me, Alan Wells, because both Senator King and Senator Collins talked about trade, but Secretary of State Kerry has listed a whole lot of other, really kind of important but sort of basic government function kinds of things, from transportation to security, law enforcement. How easy or difficult is it going to be for the United States and Cuba to work together on that long list that Secretary Kerry just laid out?
Well, I think it's encouraging, first of all, that they have already made progress in a number of these areas. You know, for 55 years, there was no conversation going on, or there was little conversation going on. There were, of course, informal talks going on despite the lack of diplomatic relations. But now you have over a whole range of sort of bread and butter issues of interaction, of migration. You know, these are huge issues. It's good to see that kind of conversation going on. I think part of the problem here is that you've got to wade through decades of mistrust. And until some of those points that we've already talked about, the democracy promotion, the emphasis on human rights, the claims that still exist, and still until there's progress done on that, that's going to limit the possibilities of the moving forward on those relations.
Tom, I want to ask you something that I probably should have asked earlier in the program. You've been working on this issue since 1992. Here we are in 2015, or I should say Let Cuba Live has been active on this issue. For you and those who have been so dedicated to this cause for so long, what was your reaction in June and July when the president made these announcements?
Well, of course, it was a major advance. We happened by coincidence to have a meeting that same day, and it was kind of a celebration. And I would add also that the last three of the Cuban Five political prisoners went back to Cuba, and Cuban leadership said they will return, which makes the point also of how does the world look at Cuba? Cuba has lots and lots and lots of friends in the global South because Cuba has stood up to the United States. That's a footnote. But the other thing is that this is just the beginning of a process, as everybody has pointed out. And what more tangible has to be done? One thing, Senator Collins had said, trade between our two countries. Well, the embargo, we call it a blockade, because it affects Cuba's imports and exports through the entire world. So it's not trade between the two countries. It's Cuba's trade with the world. And the blockade machinery is a big, cumbersome affair. And I have the fear that, and I don't know the detail of Senator King's bill, but I think lots of these bills pick little bits and pieces of the embargo machinery. But there are basic things that need to be changed. Things like no ship calling at a Cuban port can go to a U.S. port for the next 6 months. Or things like any a piece of equipment made by a foreign company, Toshiba or Siemens, medical equipment, has 10% of U.S. Component or investment is subject to the embargo. So rules like this have to be fixed. Humanitarian aid, you have to have a license to give humanitarian aid. And there is other little things on the agenda. Alan has pointed out that the democracy building, quote, quote, which is to build a political opposition, every year for years now, $20 to $30 million has been appropriated for that purpose. And there's a bill approved by a Senate committee a few weeks ago that has, again, $30 million and will be enforced those payments to Cubans' potential opponents will be enforced for the next 3 years. That has to be changed. Cuba wants Guantanamo back. And the migration, the Cuban Adjustment Act, 1965, only Cubans, when they arrive on U.S. sand or land, are assured in a year of a permanent residence, not Bangladeshis, not El Salvadorans, or any other country in the world. So these are things that need to be done.
All right. Alan Wells, why now?
That's a really excellent question, Jennifer. I've been thinking about that a lot. And, you know, for a long period of time, obviously during the Cold War, Washington contended that Cuba represented a security threat, which, you know, there was a lot of debate about. There was certainly Cuban support for guerrilla movements in Latin America and Africa during the Cold War. That ended in 1989. And so, too, did the Soviet subsidies. So Cubans wound up cutting the size of their military substantially. They ended aid to guerrilla movements. And so there was a real thought that that change might have happened right about then. Why didn't it happen then? And I think part of that has to do with a very strong Cuban-American lobby that was opposed to change. They really began to have success beginning in the 1980s, and they literally held U.S. policy hostage on this issue until 2008, until President Obama became president, well after the Cold War was over. They gave millions of dollars to both Democratic and Republican candidates. So U.S.-Cuban relations became a domestic policy issue, and because of the importance of Florida as in terms of the electoral column, that really stymied thing. So what happened? Well, the nature of the Cuban-American community, the demographics of it, changed dramatically. In 1991, 87% of Cuban-Americans favored continuing the embargo. By 2014, 52% of Cuban-Americans supported to end the embargo, and 68% want to end all travel restrictions. So there's been a dramatic change there.
So no longer, I mean, to put this in crass political terms, no longer was Florida at risk of being the decider in a presidential election for a candidate who dared speak in favor of opening relations with Cuba.
Think about this. In 2008, Obama gave one speech about Latin American issues in his campaign. He did it in Miami at the Cuban American National Foundation, and there he promoted the same policy that had been going on for decades. But he got only 35% of the Cuban American vote. By 2012, when he ran again for the presidency, he had liberalized trade relations, travel relations with Cuba, and began to open things up. He got 50% of the Cuban American vote. So you could already see that things are changing because successive waves of Cuban immigration had been coming to this country, much more open towards ending the embargo, to reestablishing trade, and for ease of movement, travel movement between the two countries.
Tom Whitney.
Yeah, I would add, in addition to what Alan said, and it's hard that you can't be in people's minds of our leaders. We don't know what they – but the pressures of dealing in a more effective way with Latin American nations, I think, is also very important. There's a whole bunch of alliances in Latin America, and Cuba has had a major role in pushing these. One is the so-called CELAC alliance, which kind of, in a way, replaces the Organization of American States. Every Western Hemisphere nation except U.S. and Canada, and I would guess that the Obama administration thought that some sort of dramatic steps had to be made for that purpose.
Alan.
Quickly, just two more things, because I know we're tight for time. But not only did the attitude of many Latin American governments change, and they pressured the administration to change policy on this, and they demanded that Cuba be allowed to participate in the summits of the Americas. But reforms underway in Cuba cannot be underestimated. When Raul Castro took over in 2008, he began to move away from the sort of what I would call the hyper-centralizing Soviet model and allow a more kind of Vietnamese-style market capitalism to take place in Cuba. And you now have purchase of mobile phones and computers, legalized private sale of automobiles and real estate, and they began to release some political prisoners. So you're beginning to see some softening there, and that made it easier for Obama to move in that direction. And finally, I think U.S. public opinion has been changing on this more generally, not just among Cuban Americans. The figures I have is that nearly 60% favored normalization with Cuba. And Obama has been liberalizing relations for quite some time. So I think all of those steps contributed to the change that we have right now.
Okay. I think we have time for one more call. Judy in Sedgwick. Judy, can you be quick?
Yes, I will try. And I think that actually some of my question has already been touched on, so maybe it can be brief. My question was for Tom Whitney. We know that Cuba is well known for exporting healthcare programs and disaster relief around the world, and has such great appreciation from most countries in the world for this type of foreign policy relationship with other countries. Could you comment on the irony between the appreciation that Cuba has earned and the fundamental desire for fundamental change of Cuba by the United States?
Well, I think you have alluded to the difference. Yes, the irony, Cuba is well known for its export of medical care, for its training of tens of thousands of physicians and teachers and the Latin American Medical School. One could go on and on. But I think what also you may be alluding to is so far the great unsaid, which is the objectives of stay the same. We want regime change. And is that right? Is it ethical? Is it moral? Is it legal under international law? Not if you read a whole bunch of, like the UN Charter. And what sticks in my mind is April 1960, Lester D. Mallory, born Holton, Maine, State Department Undersecretary, says that, and this is the policy, and it's being modified. It's been modified, the policy of changing the Cuban government by making the people suffer. Those are his words. Hunger and desperation and overthrow of the government. That's the objective. And now a softer method, perhaps, but the purpose is the same.
Judy,
and is that
yeah,
right?
Thank you for your call. And we just have a few seconds, but Alan, you want to agree with that. You find in the language that's coming from the administration that the goal of trying to bring democracy to Cuba has not changed.
No, I think the means have changed, not the ends. And I think when the administration uses terms like empowerment of the people, it's in a sense hoping that the people, if they're more economically liberated, will be able to pressure their government for political reform. So as far as many Cubans are concerned, they see it as, once again, the United States knows what's best for Cuba, and it rankles them.
All right. Well, what an interesting conversation. Alan Wells, the Roger Howell Jr. Professor of History at Bowdoin College, Tom Whitney, a former physician, a political journalist, and a longtime member of Let Cuba Live, a Maine-based committee organized to promote respect for Cuba's sovereignty and independence. John Keimel ran the board today, and our volunteer Tommy Bazarian answered your calls. We had additional help from Rich Tozier in our Bangor studio. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. And don't forget, this program will repeat at midnight. Tomorrow on the program, The Importance of the Humanities. Join host Keith Shortall and Bro Adams, who's the former Colby College president and now chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on MPBN.